Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast, your weekly dose of knife news and information about knives and knife collecting. Here's your host, Bob the Knife Junkie DeMarco.
Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast. I'm your host, Bob DeMarco. On this edition of the podcast, I'm speaking with Dave Everett. You know Dave as This Old Sword Blade Reviews on YouTube. Dave has been a practitioner of the martial arts for most of his life, training with luminaries of the field like Grand Tuhan Leo Gahe Jr. And just from personal experience, he is a bad man. Dave also owned and ran his own martial arts schools from the 70s into the 90s. Over the years, Dave became a prolific knife collector. It's no wonder being a Kali expert, a collector of knives, swords, and other edged weapons. He has a sprawling, eclectic collection that he kindly shares with the rest of the world on his YouTube channel. And I'm really excited to have him here, take the time to chew the fat with him and talk all about knives, swords, and other edged implements. But before we go there, are you irrationally fond of knives? And do you like this show? Well, then maybe you should go over and check us out on Patreon. There are three levels of support. You get Knife Junkie stickers, a mention on the podcast. You get other exclusive content, early access to the podcast with no ads during the show, and more. Your support helps fund the infrastructure needs of the show, like hosting, servers, apps, and equipment. And also, it goes to fund the purchase of knives for review and giveaway. So check us out on Patreon and see what helping us gets you. The quickest way to go there is to go to thenifejunkie.com/Patreon. That's thenifejunkie.com/Patreon.
You're listening to the Knife Junkie Podcast. If you've got questions or comments, call the 24/7 Knife Junkie listener line at 724-466-4487.
Dave, welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast. How you doing?
Thanks for having me, Bob. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. I mean, it is a pleasure to have you here. You and I met a while back when I first started the show, and you've come on Thursday Night Knives quite a bit, and I've gotten some teases and a little taste of your collection and your background, but I'm interested to get into it today because you and I have a lot of areas of interest that intersect. And I'm not just talking about your large, eclectic collection of knives with menace. I do notice a lot of your knives have menace. Yeah. But also Kali and photography and all these other things. So let's just start with a quick pocket check. Dave, I know you were carrying something today. What was it?
I guess I'll have to reach in the pocket to find out, right?
Oh, look at that.
Spyderco Amalgam. It's been with me pretty regularly these days. I put the, MXG clip on it?
Mm-hmm.
Titanium clip. I like deep carry. It's got the carbon fiber over G10 that a lot of people don't really love. I don't mind. Gives some good traction. And it is a Brendan Lai, I believe. Design.
That knife made a big splash, I remember, when it came out maybe 2 years ago, something like that. I have not yet experienced it, but I know that the flipper and the compression lock thing.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a little bit of a problem. So I'm thinking of sending it down to BJ Hill and have him do a flipper tab delete.
He does some really great work. So Dave, how'd you get into this? How did you get this love of knives? I mentioned the martial arts, but there must be something deeper. Where'd this come from?
I was born overseas on Okinawa. Hmm. The family brought back, they helped to reconstruct the island after World War II. So it gives you a little sense of my age. They brought back a lot of memorabilia, different, lacquerware and carvings, and I wish I still had it. I had a tanto that was made out of a bayonet.
Ooh.
That they had taken a bayonet and reground it completely, put it in a red lacquered handle, and you know, it becomes a stick, right? Mm-hmm. When the two halves go together.
Right.
And I had that kicking around for a while. You know, the funny thing is with my collecting, and again, I just had a immense interest in Asian cultures. I started judo training in the early 60s. Followed that with Kyokushinkai karate training, got a black belt eventually in about 67 before I went out to the West Coast to go to fine arts and photography school. So How's that for eclectic?
That's pretty eclectic. So you got out to California. That is the promised land in the United States for martial arts. What did you do once you got there in terms of martial arts?
I studied Goju Karate from another guy that I ran into out there at the University of California. That's not where I was going. And eventually ended up at a very interesting little school in Goleta, California, by the name of the Cultural School. I had a $400 Volkswagen that I picked up. Somebody had spray painted it gold, turned to brown. It was a 1959 Volkswagen. I remember because there was no gas gauge, and you had to reach down on the floor when you ran out of gas and flip this manual lever that put you on reserve.
Oh, cool.
And they gave me magnetic signs. It's a cute little couple, Ken and Mie Ota, very well known throughout California for ballroom dancing. They were ballroom dancing champions. So it was referred to as the Cultural School, Judo, Aikido, and ballroom dancing.
Nice.
And in the evening, they had the mats out, the tatami. During the day, they pulled the mats up and they taught ballroom dancing on a beautiful parquet floor.
That's not surprising to me, actually. when you think of Aikido and the movements, the footwork of Aikido, kind of seems like dancing a little bit. And well, Bruce Lee was a cha-cha-cha champion.
Right.
So it seems to be that the martial arts and dancing has a bit of a crossover.
Well, so I learned Aikido. It really was the plus for me. And a bigger plus, in 1970, I got to meet Koichi Tohei, who at the time was 10th Dan and head of World Aikido. Mm. He was visiting for a month, and I got to train with him for a few weeks. In fact, he signed one of his books for me. I cherish that. It's called Aikido in Daily Life. And he was very much the same as my sentiments about the martial arts, is blending philosophy with the art. And very much like the founder of Aikido, Morihei Ueshiba, who was a real enigma. I mean, you talk about Bruce Lee. Bruce Lee would put people down and say, technique's no good. This is, you're no good. That's no good. And, you know, he challenged people to prove it. And he'd prove it. Somebody asked him about Morihei Ueshiba. He said, he's not from this planet.
Wow.
Morihei Ueshiba was that good.
He got the respect of Bruce Lee.
He was mystical good. There were stories about him fending off somebody that came at him with a pistol.
Oh my.
And somebody who attacked him in his garden with a samurai sword.
Okay, don't take this the wrong way. I did a little bit of Aikido, just a little bit to get my butt kicked with it, I guess. But it kind of seems, in a way, like you need some mysticism to make Aikido work in the modern world anyway.
Yeah.
You know, I know it is an art. It's not necessarily the combative form of the Aiki thing.
Aikijutsu, yeah.
Aikijutsu. Kind of seems like a mystical guy like that could make something like Aikido really work.
Well, you don't meet force with force. You learn that. Mm-hmm. And my whole upbringing up to that point in martial arts was to meet force with force. When you study Kyokushinkai karate, that was Oyama's karate. Mm-hmm. And he killed bulls with his bare hands.
So how was that training with him? Was that the kind of place where you can expect to get hurt and that's part of it?
Oh, yeah. Well, I trained in the style. I didn't train directly under him. He was the head of the style. But I trained in New York City on and off from a couple of Japanese fellas that didn't much like us Westerners and felt we were soft. So they did everything they could to prove how soft we were. So I remember going to New York for my black belt test and do your best form, do your favorite form. And everybody was doing tension forms and hardening the stomach. They just came right along, popped them in the solar plexus, and they were dropping 1, 2, 3, right down the line. And it came for my turn. I did a soft, quick form so that nobody could test my abdomen.
That's a smart
And I survived.
Thinking.
I survived.
So you also owned some martial arts schools?
I owned a school called White Lotus Martial Arts Center, and we did Kung Fu, Tai Chi, and eventually Kali. And we taught the Piketty Tertia, I can't say that word, Piketty Tertia style, which is Leo Gahe style. And I was very fortunate to train under Leo Gahe for, I think, about a month altogether directly, and then under Bill McGrath from New York, which he was a senior student. And having Leo basically camping out at my school for a month was a very interesting thing.
Well, I want to hear why. let me tell you my impression of Leo Gahe. He came once to the school I used to train at, and gave a, you know, it was like a Saturday seminar, like a 6-hour thing or whatever. And he was in his 80s at the time. I think he still is, if he's not in his 90s yet.
Yep.
And he had forearms like suspension cables from a bridge. I mean, unbelievable. And he was showing us all these very aggressive knife techniques. And it was a lot of fun. And I was training with someone who was a lot newer at it than I. And he wasn't quite getting it. So yeah. Leo Gahe came over to me to us to show my partner on me. And it was an amazing feeling, I got to say, because I just completely surrendered myself to him in that it was a grappling thing. And I found myself on the ground, you know, eating mat with my arm behind my, you know, in some contorted position. But he did it very gently, but very, very, I felt like he could have snapped me in half at any moment. And he was an elderly man.
His power is very soft, but very steel-like, as you're describing. So what we used to say about the Tai Chi masters is it's like steel wrapped with cotton.
Nice. So steel wrapped with cotton.
Yeah. Yeah. It's soft on the outside, but it's totally irresistible on the inside, you know, the amount of strength that they have. And that includes the Aikido people as well. It's what they call, you know, bringing out the chi or bringing out the ki. But Mr. Gahe, Grand Tuhan Gahe, had it in spades. And I remember doing a live knife tapping session with him. He said, enough of these plastic knives and rubber knives. And he opens up his Bali song that I had given him, by the way, one of the original Benchmade Bali songs, hand ground by Jody Sampson. It was a double edge with a white micarta handle on it. I remember that. And it was latchless. And he starts out slow. And I have to tell you, training with a live knife coming at you, and he didn't cut me once, which I thank him for, gives you 100% of your attention on what's happening. It's just, there's no substitute for it. It's kind of like when people tell you about, you know, traumatic events that happen in their lives and they remember every little second of what happened. It's the same thing, because I mean, I wasn't looking to the side. I wasn't looking up. I wasn't looking down. I had my eyes right on basically the center of his body, which is where you need to look. You don't follow the knife around. You look dead center, mass of the body. And I learned a lot. Tremendous skill. He sort of combined what I learned in Aikido, what I'd learned in karate, what I'd learned in Kung Fu, all together into this beautiful synthesis. And the nice thing is it's an art I can still do today, whereas I can't do a lot of the Kung Fu stuff that requires you to jump up in the air and spin and, you know, go down on the floor and do a spinning top and whatnot. As much as there are those Shaolin masters who can do that in advanced years, I haven't met any of them personally.
Right. Well, they could be lying about their age. I remember hearing a story when I lived in New York City about a guy, an elderly gentleman who is in a fast food place. And some, you know, scumbag came up to him and started hassling him. I don't remember exactly what the guy did. He assaulted him in some way. The dude pulls out a sword cane and chops off one of his hands, you know, disappears into the night. And to me, that says two things. One, don't mess with old guys. And two, knife arts, blade arts are something that you can carry into your older adult years, because you're using an extension of your body. It's your body that starts to go as you get older.
Right.
And any sort of help you can get with that, with an implement, such as a knife or a sword cane, is going to help you. And this martial art can take you into your adult years, you know?
Oh, yeah. And I find Kali to be that. You know, you can use a cane or a stick or a knife or what have you, should you need it. But, I mean, the way that Leo Gahe trained was that at 6 years old, he was put up on a tabletop and his grandfather would try to hit his toes with a stick. And that's how he learned footwork, is to get your feet out of the way, because the feet are a target too.
Yeah.
In Filipino martial arts, whether with somebody trying to cut him with a sharp implement or strike him with a stick. So you learn the footwork first, and then you learn stick and sword. And the stick and the sword translates to the empty hand. So once you learn the weapon, it's the reverse in Kung Fu. You learn empty hand, and then you learn the weapon. In Filipino, you learn the weapon, and then you learn the empty hand.
Yeah, and the empty hand follows very logically from, you know, I've done a little bit of, well, I did some Pan and Tukin while I was doing Kali, and all of those techniques, the destructions and the various ways of approaching, the footwork's the same, the angles are the same. It's just brutal. And of the fact that it follows a weapon system is unique. It's like karate. You got to train years and years and years, and then finally they put a bow staff in your hand or something like that.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm exaggerating.
Well, a lot of it's muscle memory. I mean, there's things I haven't practiced for years that when I think of them and connect the body, I can do them. Maybe not with the same force. And one thing you have to watch out is that muscle memory. If you haven't done something in a number of years and then you try to do it full out, mm-hmm. First thing you do is pull something out of whack.
I'm not surprised.
But I wanted to see what color sling you're wearing today.
It's blue. And you should see the group of guys that jumped me. They're all in the hospital now. Just kidding.
I hope you're hiding a knife up in there now.
Oh, my God. Funniest thing. I got this sling and I was like, hey, baby, guess what? My wife's like, you're not putting a knife in there. I'm like, not that you know.
That's a great place for like a, you know, 6-inch tanto or something.
Yeah, it is. That's pretty much where they kept it in their kimono, right?
Yep.
So your martial arts schools, you had it for, you know, in the 70s, the 80s and the 90s. Was this the time when you started collecting in earnest?
Well, that's not Ernest Emerson, but I did have a few of his things. Bad joke. By the way, I never met Ernest, but I saw a lot of him in his training films and so forth. And I had a few of his pieces. But the interesting thing about my collecting, and I thought about this before coming on, is that it has been through cycles. I started collecting things fairly seriously, but not in great number, in, I would say, the late 60s. One of the pieces I wish I'd kept, which would be worth thousands today, was something I picked up at a hardware store for $40, was a John Nelson Cooper dagger. Oh. And you may or may not know who John Nelson Cooper is or was, but he was a founding member of the Knife Makers Guild, along with Loveless and those guys. So he was from that era.
Right.
In fact, he might have even preceded Loveless, but he was also the mentor to Jody Sampson, the sword maker to the stars, who was the...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and Jody hand-ground all the Balisong blades for Les Diasis.
When it was Pacific Knife Company?
It was Balisong Company.
Balisong Company. Okay, so yeah. Proto-Benchmade, basically.
Late 70s, he incorporated as Balisong Company, and they were in Burbank, California. And in the early 80s, when he became, he stayed in Burbank. In the early 80s, I would just pick up the phone and talk to them. I'd run the martial arts school. I was buying a number of Balisongs, selling them. These were the original Balisongs that were milled out of a billet of stainless steel and pinned. They were permanently attached, no screws like today's Balisongs, no bearings. It was, I think there was a sleeve inside which a pin rode.
Okay.
These, you could have any kind of scales you wanted. They basically dovetailed slots into the handles and those were slid in. And then the whole handle was contoured and made one. I could order them up with a latch or without a latch. I preferred latchless because, we carried them in what was called a cocoon. A horizontal ballistic nylon sheath that was very convenient. You could learn to peel open the flap with two fingers, keep on going, pull the Balisong out, and flip it open with
in a reverse grip
and a Pakal grip. But again, the thing I wanted to say was that my knife collecting's been through cycles. I got into it, gave it up, got into it, gave it up, got into it, gave it up. Had it been a continuum, I'd still have a lot of that stuff and I wouldn't have sold it or given it away. Mm. Now what I'm collecting, you can't keep up with it. There's Civivi's coming out with a model a week and, you know, Kaiser's coming out with a model a week. And, I think the whole YouTube channel thing is you almost get a little anxious because you're saying, well, so and so did the review on that knife that just came out last week. I didn't get to do the review yet. You know, but I'm getting to the point where, you know, you can't keep up with that race. And there are guys out there. I'm turning out a video a day. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I do it. I think I posted that out as a comment on Nick Shabazz's site. And he said, you know, even the so-called pros don't turn out a video a day. And I've been doing it for 6 months or more. But, you know, so I try to get new things in. But it's hard keeping up with that. So what I do is try to group things together and look at what I have and say, you know, here's some small folders. Here's some large folders. Here's some knives by Kaiser. Here's some knives, you know, best of kind of a thing. And interestingly enough, I get almost more views on those than I do on a single knife.
Well, first of all, people love collection videos. I myself love collection videos. But back to a point you were mentioning before about, I know what you're talking about concerning the anxiety of being the first one to get that knife.
Yep.
That was part of my instinct very early on, but I realized that's just not, that's not me. I'm not that interested in all of the new knives coming out that people want to see, you know, all the new Spyderco's and stuff like that. So to me, that's a job best left up to Slicey and Metal Complex and some of the other guys who are really, you know, have their finger on the pulse. And I love that. And that's, you know, besides their charm and insight, that's why I watch their videos, to check out what everything new is. But what I love about your channel and what I kind of go for in my channel is you don't see too many videos about the knives you show. You don't see too many videos about the knives I show. So there are others out there who want to see those.
How many videos to see about one of these?
Yeah, exactly. That's that Max Venom weirdness, isn't it?
Yeah.
I love that.
It's a crazy knife.
It is a crazy knife.
I mean, there's all kinds of ways to hold it and open it. It's a button lock. I don't hold on to it because I carry it. I hold on to it because it's a kind of an oddity, and I think they're out of production on it.
So that's another thing you have to clear up with your own collection, or one has to clear up with their own collection, is what kind of, you know, collection do you want to have? I do have, for a while, I felt like it was the DeMarco Museum of Knives. I had to have one example of every kind of unique thing out there.
Right.
And then I realized that, like, I'll be doing this forever and I'll be broke and I won't be carrying any of these. So what's the point?
Yeah. Well, you know? I'm reaching critical mass. You know, I've got way too many at this point.
What does that mean?
You want to count? You want a number?
Yeah. If you have one,
I'd say somewhere in the 250 range.
250. Okay. I think you're beyond me. Does that include swords, folders, everything?
No, that's just, in fact, that's a lot of uncatalogued Tucsons as well that are not even in that number. So there's Tucsons. I have to ask people who are more Tucson experts, what number is this? Because they don't have names, you know, and I cannot remember the numbers. I can look back on places like eBay and say, you know, let me look back and see when I got this. And sometimes they just give you the little, you know, it's cut off and you don't see the whole name and so forth. But I've been donating some. I've been sending them out for review to guys with channels like Dirk Werning. You know, he's reviewed a lot of my stuff. So, you know, if I find that he likes something, you know, I'll say, well, you know, hang on to it. And same thing with your channel. So,
yeah. As you've donated six knives to our channel. I mean, great knives too.
Probably more coming.
Hey.
You see anything tonight that you like, just let me know.
All of those Filipino swords behind you.
Yeah.
But the knives you sent are all, well, six very high quality knives. And we had a chance, we gave a couple of them out on the Patreon giveaways. And auctioned one off and for charity, and we're going to do some of that again with these. And that, you know, you reach a certain point. It's like, I could try to sell some of these, or I could give them to people who want them. And in a sense, like I could never understand that when I was a newer collector, but now I totally get it.
Right. Here's something interesting. Doesn't look like much. This started life as a live blade that probably had a flaw. So they turned it into what they call a butter knife. Can you read that?
Pacific Cutlery Corporation. So that's an early.
North Hollywood, California.
Oh, my gosh.
And that is the Kuzan Oda Tanto. I looked this up before the podcast to see if I could find one. $350 on eBay for a live one.
Wow.
And all this is a cast aluminum handle. I happen to put the silicone tape over it for grip. But, you know, this is what we use for our practice.
So did you have a bunch of those? Did all of your students carry them?
I have a pair. I had two. As far as I can, and, you know, I'd sold other things too that were called butter knives, Bally Songs included, where they'd grind off the tip and so forth. But now we've got cool stuff like this.
The Lucha Trainer.
And it's beautiful because it's every bit like the Lucha, and you don't cut yourself. So you can try out all your tricks.
So, Dave, how would you characterize your collection in general?
Eclectic. Yeah, eclectic. But, you know, I think I've held on to a lot of stuff. But it seems like my sweet spot are the higher end knives by Wee and Best Tech and some of the Reich knives. That seems to be where I settle in. Although Artisan has some really excellent stuff as well. And there's a few of those. I think the Ray Laconico one that you were showing, what the heck is it? Centauri.
Oh, that, yes. Yeah. Oh, man, I wish that were mine. I was like, I don't have any Ray Laconicos. That was a borrowed knife. Okay, so you have an eclectic. I'm trying to get to something here, which is what influence do you think your martial arts and your Kali had on your collecting today? I mean, is it all martial blades?
I like a big blade in a folder. I like at least 3.75 to 4.25. One of my favorite knives is the Blokow, the Wee Blokow. It's just a big knife. And I would aspire to get a custom at some point by Miguel Barbudo. And Miguel, a few months ago or maybe a year ago, didn't have much of a name, but now he is the head guy at Forged in Fire Latin America.
Oh, is he the host?
I believe he is. I haven't seen the show. Okay. But I know Doug Marcaida gave him his blessings and kind of started him off. But if you look on Instagram at some of Miguel Barbudo's folders and some of his Damascus and some of his fixed blades, it's all in that Spanish tradition, you know, with that point that narrows down and goes out like that, kind of like the Blokow.
Do you happen to have the Blokow nearby? Yeah,
of course.
Yeah. Oh, of course. It's one of your favorites, you said.
Well, let's see. It's always the heaviest. I pick up these pouches. And I say, well, which one is it? And it's always the heaviest one.
Yeah, this knife, man, that really gets my heart racing. I've never seen or held it, but it has a unique lock, doesn't it?
It's a window lock. They refer to it as a window lock. That tab right there, when you open it,
yeah,
snaps in there. And I'm not going to make any great claims and say it's better than cold steel, but I'll bet you it's every bit as resilient to closing accidentally, you know, with back pressure.
Yeah, for those who don't know the Blokow or aren't watching and are only listening, this looks like a back lock mixed with a scorpion lock.
It's on bearings. Ooh, so nice. What people don't like about it, and there have been some reviewers that have called it a dangerous knife, is that if you press on the back lock and you're holding it here, it's going to drop on your fingers. It's just going to release.
Right.
See? And then what you have to do is squeeze it And then that's the detent. So the window lock is also the detent as well as the locking open.
I really like that knife. I like that Spanish clip point.
Yeah.
You know, that look. So now, okay, eclectic. How do you take all of these different knives with all of these different characteristics and put them through the same bit of testing? Like, how do you test a knife? What do you consider a good knife? And how do you judge them all when they're all so different?
I like a knife that adapts to the Filipino arts, which means that I tend not to like knives that have crescent handles. The exception would be the karambit, of course. But I like the knife to be straight so that when I hold it in a square grip, which is what we like to use in Piketty Tertia, and to be able to put the thumb on the back of the blade, doesn't matter if it's got jimping or not, in that the you have the 5, 6, and 9. If you study the, you probably know what those angles are.
Bob, those are right? Angles of attack. Yeah.
Right. Straight ahead is 5. Then we got the angle in from the top, and then we got the angle coming in from here. But the thing is that, you know, it should feel balanced enough so that it turns easily in the wrist. Because you can come in here, you can cut, you can come in here, you can cut, come in here, and you can cut. So it's a thrust, turn, cut, right?
Yeah.
And we won't describe what's going on there, but it might be evident.
Yeah. So with that curved crescent-shaped handle, the point is not where you want it to be, especially on like that backhanded thrust, or is that what you're getting at?
There are some handles that place it in a in more of a saber grip. Okay.
I
got to sort of contort my wrist to show you, but where it lies this way in the hand instead of this way.
Interesting.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with this, right? It's kind of like a European fencer's grip, but the style that I studied likes the square grip. Certainly it doesn't mean you can't angle it in a moment. But we also do a lot of these flicks. So your jab would be presented that way with a loose wrist, firm grip, and deliver that point. You do the same thing in point down. So you would jab this way, right? And then there are ways to get greater extension and range and so on and so forth. But I would say that good ergo is something that fills the hand. But, you know, I make exceptions to that just based on aesthetics. So here's something that I did a review on. This is a really weird knife by Max DeChuck. And this is called the Lucky Star. It's by Concept.
Ah.
He came out with a previous model with the same blade that was blackened that he called the Prickle. So this is a high-end Prickle, if you will.
That blade is insane. Just a high-end Prickle. Describe that blade. That is a weird, that's like a drop point tanto. What is that?
It is tanto on steroids, I guess. It's got a very severe forward angle, but then he clips the point. What's interesting here is it is a straight knife, and you've got a point that's on line with the axis of the blade. It's not a particularly long one. I think it's 3.5 inches or so. The holes are completely style. They don't serve any real function. It's on bearings. Just came in today, not too drop shutty. It's a front flipper. Front flippers aren't high on my list of knives that, at least for me, are easy to deploy.
They're very polarizing. A lot of people think they're kind of an answer to a problem that never existed.
That's another front flipper that I actually find, I'll call it an end flipper.
Yeah.
That's a real steel EPON that was designed by Chad Los Baños from Hawaii. He's a martial arts guy and a law enforcement officer. And this, nice thing about this, can be used as an impact.
Pain compliance,
glass breaker. But it's very easy to flip it open. It's kind of a Japanese influenced design.
Looks like a kind of a Quaken sort of thing.
Yeah, Quaken. But yeah, I brought a lot of talking points, I call them.
Oh, that's good. Before we started rolling, I was talking about commenting about the swords behind you. Those are from a company called Traditional Filipino Martial Arts. We had Ron Kazakowski on the show quite a while ago. He's the guy who owns and runs that company. And he's also a Connecticut, he's a Pikiti Tertia teacher also, right? I mean, he's a Kali guy, but.
He is. I've been to a number of Leo Gai seminars at his school. So, yeah, he's down in Waterbury. He's not far from me.
You did all the photography it's beautiful photography for his website and catalog, right?
Since you mention it, there's his catalog and those are my picks.
So when you went out to California for fine art school, you went out for photography.
Right.
And so now, years later, you're bringing them. Well, I guess you've been working with him for a while, but this whole idea of starting your own channel and bringing some of your your passions together, knives, photography, in this case, it's videography, but sharing your knowledge of, martial arts application to these knives that you're collecting. Was that part of the goal in starting this channel?
Yeah, I think it was a passion of being able to talk about the blades, being able to collect them, obviously, being able to experience new styles as they came out and incorporate the photography. I spent 10 years as an advertising photographer out of school, basically doing what was called nuts and bolts photography. And that means industrial photography. So I would be inside factory plants and we'd be setting up shots, and they'd be keying in on, a particular safety device or a light or some wire. I had to bring electrical fittings home to my studio, which happened to be at my parents' house at the time, and make them look sexy. Some big casting,
yeah,
that was screwed on to the end. I mean, this giant cable container, and you put a mug of beer next to it and make it flow over, and all these little tricks, plastic ice cubes,
Yeah. That's hilarious. It's just like, make this spool of wire sexy to the guy who needs it.
Yeah.
Ooh, maybe I could have a beer after I use it.
I figured if I could make the electrical fittings look sexy, I can make knives look sexy. So
absolutely.
I enjoy the lighting and, setting up the shots and using different backgrounds. And, although the funny thing is you kind of get into mass production of, these videos for reviews. I find myself, I'll leave the same background there, leave the lights the same way, there's no time to change all that stuff. Let's do the review. But so what I'm thinking of doing and is basically cutting back a little bit and maybe doing 3 videos a week, something like that, where I got a little more time to spend, making them the way I want to make them and, not having to churn them out and not jumping on every, new knife, every new flash in the bucket, so to speak, because, Civivis are great knives, but they're here today. And a year from now, you may not even know what the model was, or maybe you do, because there are some people that are really hot Civivi collectors. So,
but they just have so many models.
Yeah.
You know what I would submit? You're talking about everything being the same and how part of, if you go to, 3 videos a week, part of it's going to be to change it up a little bit. But I would suggest that that as a rabid knife review video watcher, as I'm sure you are, there's a shorthand to the thumbnail. I can always tell whose thumbnail is whose. And now I know yours, you've said, your style is distinctive. So if you change, I would suggest that you keep the thumbnails distinctive.
Oh, yeah. The lighting's probably going to stay about the same. I think I've got it worked out. We would spend years, and I have to say, the guy I really, really admire, I can't say enough about his work. And I'm going to throw out there is Sharp by Coop.
Yep.
And, his photography is equal or better to, and I'm trying to remember the guy's name who did the Knives Illustrated catalog shots every year. Every year, Knives Illustrated would come out, and there'd be that big, thick journal of knives. And we're talking like 80s, I think. And the name Ken Warner sticks in my mind, but I believe he was the editor and not the photographer. Anyway.
So that's, are you talking about the big book that comes out every year?
I haven't seen it in years, but I used to get it. Yeah, I used to buy it on the magazine shelf in the store.
Yeah, I used to go to Barnes & Noble in New York and kill time looking at that.
Yeah. Until they told you, sir, are you going to buy that or read it?
Yeah, I'd say, I don't know. Are you going to ask that guy who's sleeping over there on a bunch of books? Yeah. So when you get a new knife and you know you want to review it, you know you want to put it on video, what is the process you go through to determine whether it's good or not? And do you do videos of knives that you don't find good?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I do videos of knives that are just interesting, that have hit the public, have hit social media and whatnot. And that's where I say, you know, a certain amount of restraint needs to be exercised. I do a fair amount of business with White Mountain Knives, and he's really good about getting stuff to you quick. And I know a lot of other YouTubers use him as well. So, you know, it's, you have to say, I think eventually is this going to fit in my collection? And, I'm in the midst right now of narrowing down the collection. And, you know, I don't, currently don't own any customs. So it's all, production stuff. So I haven't gone into that extreme realm where, you know, guys are throwing out all this money for custom knives. And, you know, maybe ultimately that's the thing to collect, just like people that collect watches are, you know, going for everything from Timex to Rolex and beyond. By the way, my timepiece is a smartwatch.
My timepiece is sitting on my dresser because of this stupid sling. The trends that you see, are they things that compel you to buy a knife? Well, you had a front flipper up. If we want to talk about trends, I mean, I said polarizing trend. There's nothing quite like a front flipper to get a knife nerd, you know, get his knickers in a twist.
The front flipper doesn't see a lot of pocket time. I'll tell you what I'm fairly enamored with, because they're at a good price point, and they seem to be knocking it out of the park lately, is MaxAce.
Ooh.
And that's the Sandstorm K.
Dave, what is that thing on the side? Is that a rotary lock of some sort? A secondary rotary lock?
That's exactly what it is.
Huh.
So you twist that, and it locks out the liner. And so far, it hasn't engaged on its own. But it's they really did a great job sculpting the G10. This emulates a higher-end piece that they sell for like $400, I think. And this is coming in around 100 or maybe a little over 100. But earlier I had the Amalgam out, which has nearly a 4-inch blade. So yeah, it is a large hand-filling knife. And MaxAce seems to be coming out with quite a few of these lately. I like it.
You mentioned customs a moment ago, and I'm not a mathematician, but I'm thinking about the numbers you said of folders that you have. And, you know, the relative amounts that they cost. I'm wondering if you could reduce part of your production catalog and start for the good of everyone who watches your channel. But you could, this is how I have three or four. And that's what I ended up doing. I sold a bunch to fund each one.
That's likely going to happen. I mean, that's likely going to happen. I think the thing with production knives is, if you make a mistake, it's not a big one. If you get a really expensive custom knife that you thought you liked,
yeah,
and you get it in your hand, and you know maybe it doesn't function the way you wanted it to, it doesn't feel the way, the ergos aren't right, or whatever. Certainly it probably retains value better than the production knife. So if you found an interested buyer, you could get rid of it.
Yeah, well, that's true. You find some dyed-in-the-wool collector of a certain maker, and then you can probably unload it.
Yeah.
I started with custom fixed blades. I only have, like I said, I have four. I have two fixed blades that are custom and two folders that are custom. And I love them all. I like the fixed blades better, I got to say. The folders are very good, high quality, no doubt. But maybe there was a little bit of that thing you mentioned where I was like, God, I really, but I realized once I got it, this is the first one I got, which I still really love and I will never get rid of. It was for sentimental reasons. It was someone I interviewed on the show. It was a model I'd been admiring for a long time. And then when I got it, I was like, this is awesome. This is cool. Put it in the case. You know, I never carry it. Never. And it's not because I'm afraid to. It's because it's more of a showpiece.
Well, very frequently something will come in. I review it, take a look at it, play with it. In some cases, you know, maybe loosen the pivot, get it smoothed up, do a review on it, and then goes in the drawer, and I don't see it for a while. and that's a fact. So, interesting story, real quick about custom knives. Back in the 70s, when I was studying Kung Fu under a well-known grandmaster in the Northeast, this guy that ran a series of schools in Pennsylvania, I mean, he had a lot of schools, successful as well. We decided, because the teacher relocated to Florida, we'd visit him in Florida, but we'd stop at Randall Knives. So we drove his old Lincoln Continental from Pennsylvania down to Orlando, Florida, drove down this old swamp road to what looked like a shack in a small house. And that was Randall Knives. And there was a small showcase, nothing ostentatious, out front, you know, had a few of the models in there. So not everything, even at that time, was available to just purchase.
Yeah.
But he bought a couple. I bought a small boot dagger. So again, I don't have them. Mm. I had a custom Terzola my students bought for me. It was a Chris. It was a custom. It was made.
Wait. Your students bought it for you and got rid of it?
Yeah, well.
Dave, you've got a cold heart, my friend. Oh, my God.
Knife's a knife. It's cold steel. But the thing I didn't like about it at the time is nothing on Bob.
Yeah.
And I had a few of Bob's knives that I bought through a guy, Doug Kennefick, who is a big Randall knife dealer up in Connecticut. You go to his house and you would see 200 Randalls in the case, amongst other Crawfords and all kinds of stuff. He even had the Sasquatch Bowie made. That was his design. It's a weird recurve.
Yeah.
That Sasquatch Bowie was Doug Kenefick's design that Randall made. But at any rate, you know, we went down to this little place. Everybody's all relaxed there. Talked to you for a while. A little bit of a southern drawl going on. I don't think I met Bo Randall. I think I met his son. But, you know, we bought our stuff and went on our way. But that was my my one time visiting Randall Knives.
Well, you mentioned to me a while back that you worked with Norm Bardsley, a knife designer or a knife maker, knife maker.
Rhode Island. Yep.
And you ended up actually designing a knife?
There was a Collie knife that I had designed. And to tell you the truth, the design, exactly what it was, escapes me. I know we were looking for a small Pakal knife at the time. This was preceding anything that was commercially available. We're looking for like a 3-inch. Bill McGrath always said he really liked a 3-inch double edge for an ideal Pakal knife, because no matter how you rolled it, no matter how it was in the hand, it was, you know, always in the right position. That's the thing about a double-edged knife, right?
Yeah.
It's like that ice dagger I did the review on by Topps recently. Yeah. No matter how you roll it, that comes very close to the right qualifications, because the Pakal knife is used a lot for trapping and, you know, jabbing, tapping with your forearm, trapping, using the blade as a hook, right? Mm-hmm. Not too many things at that time qualified, and things like the Gerber Mark II double-edge Vietnam combat knife was too long. It was about a 7-inch, as I recall, had one of those. But we did finally have this knife, a prototype made. I don't know if it ever went into production. I don't know if we ever even sold any. I think closest it came was like wood or plastic. But Norm Bardsley used to make handles that looked like an alligator's mouth with the eye and the teeth out of ivory. And he made some real crazy stuff. He was out of Pawtucket, Rhode Island, I believe.
I looked him up, and a very wide range of designs and styles from him. Some very fantasy looking stuff.
Yeah.
Some very, very business looking stuff.
Yeah.
And then some like outdoor hunting kind of a very.
Yeah.
To me, if I were a knife maker, I think I would be more like that. That the type of guy who on a certain day, I just feel like making a fantasy dagger. I'm going to do that.
He was a regular stopping by the school as well. He made me some sticks out of paca wood.
Ooh.
You know, which is that compressed wood and resin.
Yeah.
And so he made me some pretty heavy duty sticks, like a 1-inch diameter, 28 inches long. That thing feels like ironwood. But the only problem is if you hit it against something really hard, like steel or whatnot, it'll shatter.
And it'll also vibrate up your arm.
Right. Speaking of sticks, this is a Gijo stick that Ron Kozakowski sells.
Oh, yeah.
And this Gijo wood has, there's no finish on this. This is the waxy resin that comes up like lignum vitae.
Mm, the hardest wood.
This stuff will sink and it can be at the bottom of the ocean for 100 years. It comes up and it's not rotted or depleted in any way.
Wow.
But this is a great little exercise tool, and I put a little grip tape on here. But if you want to practice, learn sticking and sword, that's the thing to practice with.
Why? Because it's weighted at the front and
it's know, heavier, some, yeah.
Okay.
And it's better than an axe handle.
Yeah, and it looks like it would have the effect.
It's got a defined edge. It's octagonal. And yeah, when it hits with authority. I don't think a lead pipe would do much better. And it wields a lot better.
So what other, I know you got tons of folders. You obviously have those cool Filipino swords behind you. What other kind of implements do you have? Hatchets, axes, tomahawk kind of things?
No tomahawks or axes. I did have a couple of Rons.
What's that?
A Igorot axe.
Oh. The headhunting axe.
Yes. Oh, yes. I had a couple of those. There's two different styles of those. And I still have I had a claymore, Scottish claymore.
The big giant sword.
It was almost as tall as me. I'm not professing to be extremely tall, but it was just under 6 feet. And I still have a Braveheart sword.
So you have a thing for those big ass swords.
They were novel at the time. I had to take photos of them. And what happened in some cases was I took the photo and, you know, rather than pay me for the photo, I'd collect the sword until there was almost no place to put them anymore. And my wife said, "You got too many swords." And they ended up getting sort of sold out. So I've probably got a half dozen or so left, including a sword cane and a spear.
Oh, nice.
The spear is really nice. It's, if you look at his website, it's called a Northern Spear. It's got an interesting knife-like head with a hook on the top and a belly on the bottom. So you could do some interesting stuff with that.
Northern Spear. Some interesting stuff, you say, Dave.
Yeah.
So what are the – I think the appropriate answer to your wife was, no, I don't have too many swords. We don't have enough house.
Yeah, well.
The sword room needs to expand.
For that reason, a lot of this stuff is going to need to, you know, find its way out of here sooner or later. So I am whipping up some sales online and whatnot. Might do some YouTube sales. We'll see. So I've seen some success with that. So, you know, got to narrow it down to probably, you know, a dozen production knives that I really like. And then we'll see. Maybe you'll get into some customs. But I think probably what I'll do is, you know, get into the pass around groups and some of those, and that way have exposure to more without having to commit to purchasing it.
So you're gonna pare down 250 some odd to a dozen. Yeah. Of really, wow, that's That's admirable. I don't think I could do that, but
I'm selling you 100. So,
oh, okay. I'll take them. I'll take each one. So what you said cycles, you're cyclical. I'm yeah. similar. Like I go through a slip joint phase and then a fixed and then a always in a tactical folder phase. Yeah. What do you think your next phase is?
And by the way, my cycles have to do, at least up to this point, with being on and off collecting altogether.
I'd
collect a few. And when I had the martial arts school, we were selling knives and martial arts merchandise. So the Bally Songs kind of fit in. Again, I pick up the phone, call a Bally Song, have Les Diasis on the line. They would BS for about an hour. I talked to the guys in the shop and he said, well, you know, what kind of handles do you like and this and that? So he basically custom built the knife for me over the phone. A few weeks later, I'd have it. But I got in and out of that. As I said, I'd still have a lot of Bally Songs around, although I sold a bunch to students, but I'd still have some around if I didn't drop out of that phase. So, you know, we'll see where I go from here. Like, I have a lot of interests. Want to get back to doing some more drone flying. And, you know, it was photography that got me into drone flying. I love the aerial perspective and what you can do. I've shot real estate and I've shot dragon boat races and all kinds of interesting stuff, but I'm slowing down a little. So I got to, you know, I'm kind of parse my time out a little more wisely.
Yeah. Well, I just got into Randall knives and yep. I'm trying to push myself back from that. But that's my recent infatuation. Do you get like that? Do you get infatuated?
Oh, yeah. Well, Max Ace has sort of got me for a while because at least the ones that I'm picking up lately are affordable. I like stuff like this, right? Looks like a traditional Quaken.
Yeah.
And that's the Samurai. That sort of stuff, when I see that a blade shape that interests me, when I see a handle that I know can be functional, I like it. I like exotic handle materials. You know, if it's a fancy wood or something, I might pick it up. Although it seems like most everything is either carbon fiber or G10, you know, if in my collection at this point, or titanium. What I'm looking for next, I don't really know. It seems like when I see it, I know it, you know. Just got to share something else quick.
Please.
I was really infatuated by this design by Bestech. It's a $50 knife.
It's beautiful.
The work they did on the fuller up the middle, and you can get it in a blackened blade. You can get it with blackened with that fuller natural. It's got a deep carry clip. I'm a fanatic for deep carry clips. I don't really care for knives where they leave about an inch sticking out of your pocket. You know, I realize there's upsides and downsides to that. Look, they even put a usable finger choil on a dagger style blade. That's crazy, you know?
I'm going to be honest with you, Dave. I love the way that thing looks, but it sticks in my every dagger design that isn't double-edged sticks in my craw. I say, yeah. If you're well, and I'll tell you why. It's not just that I would prefer double edges or the aesthetic thing, but it's also that means that the swedge or the thinness at the tip of the blade is going to run all the way up to the handle on the dorsal side. So when you're putting your thumb down in that grip, it's a very thin.
Right.
Whereas a bayonet grip would leave you a little fat section it tapered.
Gave you a nice bit of jimping here, though.
Oh, yeah.
So if you don't lay your thumb all the way down and you bring it back, you've got some very usable jimping there. They gave you a little bit here on the back strap, and there's jimping right there.
Yeah.
I mean, for $50 and on bearings and drop shut, for a dagger, I mean, it's hard to beat. And no, it's not. It looks perfectly symmetrical, but I think Jared at Neve's Knives said it wasn't quite symmetrical. But I'm not seeing that. I'm seeing it being symmetrical. But you know.
Yeah. Well, I guess once you sharpen it a couple of times, it won't be.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, Dave. I like to wrap up these interviews with guys like you who have YouTube channels and who have huge collections or any collection, but you know, that collector instinct. I like to run you guys through a speed round where I'm just asking you questions to which I get a one-word answer. And so this is going to really give us a profile of who you are as a knife collector.
I'm an enigma, but give it your best.
All right. All right. Speed round, sir. And okay. All right. Here we go. Fixed or folder?
Folder.
Flipper or thumb stud?
Thumb stud.
Washers or bearings?
Bearings.
Tip up or tip down?
Tip up.
Always. Tanto or Bowie?
Bowie.
I'm shocked. Okay. hollow ground.
It depends upon whether it's an Americanized Tanto or not. I'll take a traditional Tanto.
Okay. Without the faceted front, without the sharp angle up front.
Which was
okay.
never a Tanto anyway, but I digress.
Hollow ground or flat ground?
Flat ground.
Full size or small?
Full size.
Gentleman's knife or tactical knife?
Tactical knife.
Automatic or Bally Song?
Automatic.
Really? Again, shocked.
Yep.
With your background. Zero tolerance or Riat?
I've never had a Riat.
Okay.
I do have several zero tolerance, so I'll say zero tolerance.
How about this? Zero tolerance or we?
We.
Okay. You see what I was going for? Sort of that.
Yeah.
US versus China.
Yeah.
In the high-end manufacturing. Okay. Benchmade versus Spyderco.
Benchmade.
Real steel or steel will?
Real steel.
Milled titanium or spring pocket clip?
Spring pocket clip.
Carbon fiber or micarta?
Micarta.
That was the correct answer. Finger choil or no choil?
Finger choil.
Form or function?
Function.
I like that you had to think about it. Most people are like, function, function. Me, I'm like, form. Hopefully it works well.
I'm looking for the knife that has both.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, and finally, and this is the hard one. One knife for the rest of your life. That's that desert island knife. What would it be?
I would take a Hogue Buttonlock.
Hogue Buttonlock? Oh, yeah. What is that, the ESO3?
I think this is the – they don't label them. I think that's the O3 with the G-Mascus. It's such a solid knife. You can't go wrong with the Buttonlock. It's got the double lock if you need it. It's got their Piranha grip, which is crazy grippy without wrecking up your pocket.
And it's an Elishewitz design.
I got that, and I got a EX. I think that one I just showed you was EX01, and I have the EX03, which is the phenolic molded handle.
Oh yeah.
That's in a Tanto. That's in a very usable Tanto.
That was the first Hogue knife I had. I liked it a lot. I ended up selling it, but that's just what happens when we need to get new knives.
I like the button locks. They're a good way to go. I mean, I like Axis. I like the Able lock, which is the, you know, Axis ripoff, so to speak. But I like the button locks. Hogue does they don't wiggle. I mean, you take a knife like this, there's wiggle in that blade.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's like no bushings or anything. That thing rides right on the blade. The handle rides on the blade. But you take that Hogue I just showed you. It's just drum tight, solid, and so are their autos. So I like them as a company.
I do too. It's a family owned company. They've been around for 40 years or something like that.
I liked your interview. Your interview was great.
Yeah, he's a really cool guy. Dave, tell everyone where they can catch up with you, where they can find your videos, or any other social media. And how they can reach out to you if they want to find out more.
Basically, I'm on Instagram as The Sold Sword, and I'm on YouTube as The Sold Sword Blade Reviews. Best way to contact me if you want to IM me on Instagram, that's a good way to send me a personal message or contact me, and then we can arrange email and whatnot after that.
Well, Dave, I'm glad that this latest cycle of collecting has spurn the genesis of your channel. I really like it. You really have that eclectic collection of knives that there aren't a lot of videos of out there. And I think that's maybe a unique selling proposition to your channel, is that you can go to your channel to see reviews of not of that Max Ace or that weird one you were just holding up. And that's kind of what that's kind of how I'm starting to see my own channel, like just showing things that there aren't too many of out there, because I'm just following what I like. And I think you're doing the same thing.
Bob, you're doing a great job. I got to take a moment to give you a shout out too, because I follow your channel, I follow your podcast, and nobody's covering the knife world like you are.
Oh, thank you. Me and Jim. Jim and I do it together.
Oh, and Jim. Yeah. Kudos to Jim.
Yeah.
He's the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain, right?
Yeah, he is. The power behind the throne or whatever. Anyway, Dave, thanks a lot for coming on the show. Thank I really you, appreciate your coming on and sharing all this with us.
Pleasure to be here. Catch up with you soon.
Ever strop a knife again, even though it gets no real use? Face up to what you are. You're a knife junkie.
Well, it was great to have finally a concentrated conversation with Dave. He comes on Thursday Night Knives, and like I said, we email and that kind of thing. But it was great to just sit down and talk with him for an hour. I wonder sometimes, you know, I think Dave's got maybe 12 to 15 years on me. And I wonder in 12 to 15 years what my collection is going to be like. And if I don't either slow down or start selling stuff off or change my tastes, I might be, you know, I might be up to my neck in them. Yeah, interesting guy. I'm so happy I got to have Dave on the show. Watch him on This Old Sword Blade Reviews. You can check out a lot of very interesting knives that other people are not doing reviews of. So for Jim, working his magic behind the switcher, I am Bob DeMarco saying, have a wonderful week and meet us back here next week for another great interview. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Knife Junkie Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review at reviewthepodcast.com. For show notes for today's episode, additional resources, and to listen to past episodes, visit our website, theknifejunkie.com. You can also watch our latest videos on YouTube at theknifejunkie.com/YouTube. Check out some great knife photos on theknifejunkie.com/Instagram, and join our Facebook group at theknifejunkie.com/Facebook. And if you have a question or comment, email them to bob@theknifejunkie.com or call our 24/7 listener line at 724-466-4487, and you may hear your comment or question answered on an upcoming episode of the Knife Junkie Podcast.